Welcome to Fracking and Hell, Ask a Scientist. The Endocrine Disruption Exchange has been studying the health impacts from unconventional oil and gas development, also known as fracking, since 2004. In each episode, our Executive Director, Carol Kwiatkowski, asks the scientists to answer a question on how fracking may affect your health. You can submit your question at TEDx.org.
Welcome to episode 2, Is Our Food at Risk? Today we're talking about the safety of livestock that we depend on for food. Michelle Vanberger is a veterinarian in private practice and a researcher who investigates the links between human and animal health and unconventional fossil fuel extraction. Dr. Vanberger, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you, Carol.
You've conducted studies and published on this topic. So tell us, how can livestock be exposed to chemicals associated with unconventional oil and gas production?
Well, I think, Carol, a lot of people don't realize that most of these unconventional oil and gas operations are located in farmland. In fact, sometimes right on the farm or right nearby a farm. So that's a huge exposure right there, not only for the farm animals, but also for the people who are living on the farm. But the other thing is that livestock are, for the most part, outside all of the time. Now, having said that, dairy herds are inside, too, but oftentimes they're let out. Certainly, there's a lot of ventilation in a dairy barn. So if they're not outside, they're certainly getting that outside air going through the barn. They really have to have that for their health. So having said all that, it's easy to understand that anything that's in the air, the livestock are going to be exposed to. As far as water contamination goes, they will be exposed if there have been spills of drilling, fluids, fraction fluids, or wastewater. And all of the cases that we have seen have had one or several of these exposures that I'm discussing now. And when that sort of thing happens on a cattle farm or to livestock, then their pond becomes contaminated, their creek can become contaminated. And if the well waters become contaminated, then that will affect dairy cattle, for instance, that will depend upon a well water in many situations. The other thing that people don't realize sometimes with contamination is the soil. The soil can become contaminated. The grass, therefore, may hold some of those contaminants. But regardless of that, cows, when they eat grass, they will pick up soil and eat soil as much as a pound a day. And that sounds like a lot to us, but when you think about a 1,500-pound dairy or beef cow, that's probably nothing. But still, they're taking in the soil. So if soil will oftentimes bind and hold on to a lot of these chemicals that are used in industry for long periods of time. And so, Carol, the other thing I want to mention in regards to exposure is that when we first started our studies, we didn't think that we'd have any sort of control of this, be able to look back and compare the cases that were exposed to those that maybe were not. But we weren't thinking at that point that farmers do keep, a lot of time, do keep their herds split. They'll keep one group of animals, cows, on one pasture up on the hill, say, another down by the creek. And what has happened in these cases of contamination is we can then compare the cows that have been exposed to contaminated creek water to cows up on the hill and look at exposure and also look at the symptoms and be able to see in all of these cases where they have split herd cases, where we can see where the cows that are not exposed, those cows up on the hill, for instance, compare those to the ones that have been exposed to the contaminated water, for instance. There's a huge difference in health issues. Those ones up on the hill have not had any sort of issues change. Their health has remained the same. The ones that have been exposed, we do see a lot of different problems.
And what symptoms are the most common among those exposed animals?
Right. And so what we have seen is many similar symptoms between small animals with people and food animals. But the thing that really stands out with food animals is reproduction. And that was another thing I think we weren't expecting initially. But when you think about it later, it makes a lot of sense. And that's because we're dealing with animals that are pregnant a lot of the time. These are cattle with long gestation periods where the farmers want to keep them cranking out calves, want to keep the milk supply up, for instance, or want to keep their beef supply flowing. So you've got herds. We had herds from anywhere from 20 to 200 animals. And here we're talking about unconventional oil and gas operation right there on the farm or very close nearby. The thing to think about that people can think about is suppose a birthing center for people was located right there next to an unconventional oil and gas operation. It would be the same thing. A lot of pregnant women exposed to these contaminants a lot of the time. Likely we would start to see problems with the moms as well as with those babies that were born because of all the exposure. So the sort of things we saw were increases in abortion and stillbirths, failure to cycle and failure to breed. And those things can knock a farmer down when you're really dependent upon cattle producing, continuing to produce. When things like that happen, it's very, very expensive for a farmer. And I just want to add here, Carol, that we did a follow-up study approximately two years after the original study. And what we did see was reproduction problems went down. Now, they were still higher than before the oil and gas came in, but they went down drastically. And we think they went down for two factors. One was remediation of those areas where contamination had occurred. And the second was that farmers simply got smart and moved their cattle away from areas that they thought were next to a wastewater impoundment, that were downhill, that were located where people might be dumping wastewater. Any of those situations, they moved their cattle away, just took out those exposures, removed them, and we think that's why the reproduction problems that we were seeing fell. What we also saw, though, were respiratory problems as well as growth and stunting problems went up significantly. So why might that be? Possibly due to air contamination increasing, especially in areas where infrastructure was being put in, like compressor stations and processing plants. And the growth and stunting is interesting in light of the human studies, which I won't get into, which have showed some of these issues with human babies in several areas of the country.
Yes, thank you. Have there been documented cases of contamination of the food supply?
Yes. Well, as far as that goes, there has been only one case that has been quarantined so far, and that happened in 2010 in Pennsylvania with a beef cattle herd, and that was due to wastewater exposure. And that case was quarantined due to the finding of strontium in the wastewater. Those beef cattle, once they got out past the quarantine time, did eventually enter the food chain. But I think the really important take home here for the audience is that those cattle were never tested. The meat was never tested. The milk was never tested. None of that was tested before slaughter. And I think that that's a really important point to make there, because we, in our studies, have documented many cases where animals, food animals, have been exposed to air and water contamination. And in none of those cases has anyone followed through to say, hey, look at this farm here. There might be something going on here. Let's jump in here and let's just take a little bit of milk before this goes on to the supplier. And let's just test. Let's just see, is there anything here? That, unfortunately, has not happened as of yet, as far as I know.
And that raises the question of what is the likelihood that contaminated livestock can enter the food system? And if it did, how would we know?
Those are really great questions, Carol. And I think that, for one, people should think of, okay, where do you get your food from? If you are living in an area where there is a lot of unconventional oil and gas, and you know that you're getting your milk from a local supplier there, you might want to think twice about that. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't support your local farmers. I think what farmers are doing is great. We should always support our local farmers. However, if you're living in an area where there's lots of contamination, you might want to think about, maybe I should really do some research here. Look into an area where there is not this sort of industrial complex going on, this industry or other industries which could be polluting the air or water, and get my food supply from there. So maybe organic would be a good start for those folks. But I think the other thing to keep in mind is that at this point, when you say, okay, how about my milk? Well, that milk supply from that farmer, say, that's living and producing near an oil and gas operation is going to be sending his milk supply to a big producer, and that's going to be dumped into a tank with a lot of other milk from a lot of other farms that may or may not have any contamination. So there's a likelihood, and I don't know what the risk is, but there's a likelihood that those contaminants will be diluted out in that situation. But as far as your second question there goes, how would we know if the food is contaminated? We really will not know without testing of the food for residues. And currently, right now, there is no testing of unconventional oil and gas residues in food. And I just want to add that I did get a chance to speak to one of the people involved on that case that happened in April in 2010 in Pennsylvania that did do some of the work and studies for the government. So there's a group called FARAD, which is Food Animal Residue Avoidance Data Bank. And what they do is they look at chemicals that are commonly given to food animals, such as antibiotics, for instance. And they estimate, and I think that's an important word to keep in mind here, is they estimate withdrawal times based on other studies that have been done with lab animals, for instance. And what they did was come up with a withdrawal time for strontium in that case. But what I wanted to know, when I called that individual who was co-director of that institute back in 2010, what I said was, what about all of these other chemicals, these unconventional oil and gas chemicals, not antibiotics? What about them that these cows might be exposed to because they're living right there? When are you going to test for them? When are you going to consider that? And what he told me was pretty startling, but he confirmed that basic knowledge, such as hold times for animals exposed to unconventional oil and gas contaminants is lacking. And it's lacking, Carol, due to federal funding for this. There is no funding for this. If there were, we would be able to move forward and say, hey, let's get some of that milk we just talked about from that farm near there. Can we start with even one of these major chemicals that's produced by unconventional oil and gas and say, are there any residues in here? So it really comes down to a matter of funding. And to be honest, this individual at this time gave me the impression that it was a fight to even keep his organization going, working for the government to do the residue testing, even for antibiotics, which are very, very commonly used in food animals. So I think that gives you a huge overview of, wow, how limited the funding is. And we're talking about pushing beyond that for these areas for unconventional oil and gas. It just almost makes you feel like somebody else has to step up here and say, okay, I'm going to jump in for this funding problem.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, Dr. Bamberger, and for your groundbreaking research that has led to all this knowledge and your time with us today.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you for listening. TEDx is a nonprofit research institute funded by grants from private foundations and by donations from individuals who care about our health and the environment. Visit our website at tedx.org for more information on what we do, to submit a question for a scientist, or to make a donation.